Hello and welcome to the Shropshire Witches podcast. Today is our fourth episode, which I can't believe. Time absolutely flies. And today we are going to be talking all about the folklore of the sea, as well as folklore of kind of bodies of water, I suppose, as well. So, yes, really looking forward to getting started.
I can't wait. Sorry, yeah, you go. You keep going, Amy. Sorry, that was so smooth of me, wasn't it?
No, that's fine. And I don't know what about you, but when we think about the folklore of the sea, Shropshire doesn't necessarily come to mind because I'm terrible at geography. It's not my strong point, but I know that our county is nowhere near the sea. It's probably as far away from the sea as you could be, really. And probably Birmingham's probably that, but we're pretty close. But there is quite a connection in Shropshire to sea-based mythology and folklore. Mm-hmm. So we want to start off by exploring some of that. And then as we hear about tales of the sea, fan out, follow the River Severn down from its source, from Shropshire, down to the coast and talk about some wonderful sea-based folklore. So the real connection to Shropshire and some of the things we're going to be talking about is actually mermaids. Mm-hmm. Shropshire, rather bizarrely, has at least four stories about mermaids, specifically mermaids, which when I first, right at the beginning of me looking at Shropshire folklore, didn't expect it, was a bit out there. It was kind of similar to the pterodactyls that are said to be seen in parts of Shropshire. It's a bit like, what?
Doesn't seem like an obvious fit, does it?
But yeah, it's like, okay, we'll vibe with it. So the first story I want to talk to you about is the mermaid that is said to live at Child's Arkle. Which is kind of not that far from me, really. It's kind of up Telford way, past Telford, kind of as you're getting into North Shropshire. As I said, geography is not my strong point.
That'll be fine. That's clear enough. We kind of get it. It's clear enough.
We'll get vague, but it'll be fine. And this mermaid, this first mermaid, we're actually given a little bit of an origin story about. And we're told in various stories, various versions, slightly different tales, but we're told that she had originated in the sea. So she was originally a sea-based creature and a local sea captain who had spent his life sailing around the world had actually found her. Now, in some versions of the story, he had kidnapped her. Well, I suppose it'd be fish-napped, would it be?
Fish-napped.
He'd fish-napped her.
Yeah.
But in other versions of the story, you get a little bit more of a glossing over. So it's the idea that she and he fell magically in love with each other and they were devoted to each other. So he took her from the sea and he put her in Child's Arkle Pool.
Okay.
This story kind of dates from the version I'm going to tell is from the 1800s, but there are various versions going back about 100 years before. Mm-hmm. And we're told that the mermaid was quite happy living in her pool. It's a relatively big pool, so it's not like she was stuck in a little duck pond or something.
Plenty of room, yeah.
Yeah, she's got plenty of room. But it all started to change when her sea captain, either her kidnapper or her love, depending on which version, he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
When he passed away, his family started treating the mermaid very cruelly and being not very nice and not very fair to her. So she retreated to the bottom of the pool and she stayed there to guard the captain's treasure. Because mm-hmm. that's one thing that's omitted until this point is that he was fabulously wealthy and in true eccentric fashion, rather than keeping it in a vault or a bank, he stuck it all at the bottom of a pool.
Logical.
Logical. Makes sense. So we follow this story on for a little bit and we meet two workers, normal, average Joes. We don't get their names, but they are walking to work one day mm-hmm. and they walk past the pool. And suddenly they see this absolutely stunning, beautiful woman in the middle mm-hmm. of the water. And she is calling to them. And in certain versions of the story, we're told that they're terrified because it's a mermaid. But in other versions of the story, they're captivated by her beauty. And they start to wade out into the waters. And all of a sudden, she screams a blood-curdling scream and tries to drag them to the bottom of the pool and disappears for the rest of eternity. Now, this is definitely a very moralistic story, I think. In various versions, in some versions, the men actually get close to the gold. In other versions, they probably are a bit too handsy with the woman, the mermaid. But in all of these, we get this very strong moralistic idea of how greed is a problem, how lust is a problem, and how you shouldn't necessarily be following your desire for those kind of things, which I think is interesting because mermaids, there's two real symbolisms, I think, with mermaids. They are either a symbol of sexuality and femininity and almost lust in a way, or they are a symbol of the dangers of water. And in this story, we are getting exactly the same things as we would have if this was set in an actual traditional mermaid kind of area like the seaside. So I think it's very interesting to think of this rather charming, very beautiful creature dragging these men to the depths. And that is a theme throughout Shropshire's folklore when it comes to mermaids, is they bloody love drowning men.
And why not?
You've
got it. You've got to exercise these things on. Have they done enough to us? But yeah, that's fair.
And there's another mermaid that's mentioned very briefly, kind of. So the pool itself dried up in the 18th century. So the story would have been kind of pre or around the same time. And that is a mermaid that lived in Newport. And she was said to kind of do similar things, similar activities, you know, dragging women, men off and things like that. But the other mermaid I want to just mention, I will come back to mermaids slightly later when we start looking at a place called Dairy Pit in Shropshire, but I want to just mention the mermaid in Bowmere Pool.
Okay.
Now, Bowmere Pool has an absolutely fascinating folklore. You've got a ghost of a Roman soldier who is said to, on Easter Sunday, sail out into the middle of the lake looking for his lost love. You've got the Bowmere fish and its associations with Wild Edric as well. But it's also said to, on the north side of Bowmere Pool, have been a site of a murder. So there was a little knoll kind of area where there was a very, very brutal murder happened. And our old fella, Jim Payne, an old man in the 1840s, decided that this area, this site of this brutal murder, was the perfect place for a nap. So he had this nap, and as he lay in the grass, probably feeling quite comfortable, quite relaxed, he's by a lovely, lovely body of water, he starts to drift off. He hears bells ringing and he's thinking, well, to be honest, the church isn't anywhere nearby. Why am I hearing this? And he looks out into the pool in a bit of a haze, and he notices there's some very, very beautiful women who also take on the form of fishes. We're never really given a much more of a description of these fish women. So I don't know whether they're the more traditional mermaids, as in, like, you know, beautiful young women with tails. Mm-hmm. I like to think of them as fish heads with big lashes and, you know, they're glamorous fishes.
That's really exciting. I love that idea. I'm all for that.
But he sees them and he starts to listen to their song. They're singing. He starts to panic at first when he hears a song, but he finds that his body won't move. He can't run away. He's spellbound by the sound of these women. Mm-hmm. And he falls into a deep sleep. And this deep sleep lasts for longer than he knows. But when he wakes up, he has lost his mind. He's said to have lost all reason, to have walked around grazing on grass, eating green apples and lying in with the swine in his daughter's pigsty. And this happens for some time. Jim loses absolutely goes off the rails for 7 years. And it's not until he, or her, well, his daughters contact a witch. We always seem to come back to witches in this,
yeah,
which is...
You've got to. It is never too tenuous, yeah.
Very, very on brand. And this witch is able to help him.
Mm-hmm.
She tells him to not go back to Bomir Pool ever again, but to lie beneath a rose bush and eat sunflower seeds. And this simple charm actually brings Jim back to his senses. It allows him to become the person he was before, and it allows him to break the mermaid spell. And yeah, he never does go back to Bomir Pool. But what I find interesting is you've got this double-pronged idea of magic. Mm-hmm. You've got the magic of the mermaids, which almost links to kind of like sirens in Greek mythology and things like that, this beautiful song, but with terrible consequences. And then you've got this witch, something that would traditionally be seen in a negative light, actually being able to help the man and help him from being hindered any further. So we really do have kind of quite an interesting relationship with mermaids in the county, particularly considering we're nowhere near the sea. But mm-hmm. I do think it's probably linked in some way to the River Severn being such a important trade route for most of its history. So a lot of the River Severn's history, it was the main route out of the county. It was the way in which goods came into the county. So I do believe some of these stories will have transferred from their place of origin through to the county, particularly the first one, because we know from the story she's said to have been a mermaid captured from elsewhere. She's come from the sea. She's been brought to the county. So it very much feels like the transition of the oral kind of tradition, I think. And I think that would lead quite nicely. We've come from the sea to go back to the sea and hear a little bit about some sea folklore.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I find that fascinating, that idea that these stories are transient as well, like you say. So the fact that, you know, because when we discussed that we were going to do this, I was like, right, don't tell me anything in advance. I'm not going to look anything up in terms of Shropshire, links with mermaids and things like that. And it's delivered, because that is so fascinating. And I think, like you say, it doesn't seem an obvious choice, but actually the fact that the Severn had, and Shrewsbury Place had that kind of trade route that these stories came into being, and that these bodies of water, I suppose a bit like, because you'll never expect the mermaid's pool in Staffordshire. Is it Leek? Where is it? Have you heard about this? There's a pool, and it's, I can't remember the story, I wish I knew, but there's one in Staffordshire, which is obviously pretty inland as well, and they've got a similar-ish story about this mermaid pool that's quite famous. And I was thinking, God, you know, it's funny how these bodies of water sort of pick up stories. I suppose it's human nature to want to explain something, isn't it?
Yeah.
Other to us. Sorry, yeah, you go.
Oh, no, I think as well, it links even to something as silly as swimming. How many people could swim? So if you go to Frog Well, which is near between Acton Burnell and Cardington, just briefly, it's meant to be a place in which the devil dwells in the form of a great big frog.
Big. It's naturally, boy. Old lad,
I like to think about it as being the place that the devil takes his holiday. So some people go to Butlins, some people go to Centre Parks, the devil goes to Cardington. That's just in my own headcanon, but I like to think of it as being that. But this body of water isn't actually that deep. It's relatively lost at the moment. We don't really know where it is, but we know from the folklore it existed. But there is some idea that it was a pre-Christian water source, and therefore there's this double-pronged idea of stay away from the pre-Christian water source, because we're Christian now, we need to be sensible and do Christian things. But also, if people can't swim, if children can't swim, there is that element of fear about water. And that's where I think some of these stories about women dragging men to the depths, or Jenny Greenteeth who drags children to the depths, they all come from this lack of ability with water, lack of swimming, I think, to a certain extent. So I think that's very much linked to it.
It's fascinating, isn't it? This idea that maybe if there were some beautiful young women bathing and things, leave them the chuff alone. Don't go there because you'll drown. But that's just like a way of keeping perverts at bay. Sure, you'll drown. Let's just tell them they'll drown. Same as if you say, like, don't do this, your penis will fall off. And they're like, oh, better stay away then. You're like, yeah. So the girls are like, excellent, it worked. Just tell them they'll drown. And now we can bathe and they won't touch us. You're like, okay, give it another couple of centuries. They'll be bad. Don't worry about that. I think that's fascinating. And I suppose it leads on, I was saying to you, in terms of what we talk about will be quite varied. But if we're going to go to the sea, I think first and foremost, we've got to talk about Davy Jones's locker. Oh,
yes.
Because I find this fascinating. Now, I've looked into this on and off for years because I always loved the phrase. I think its exact origins vary. Largely, it seems to be 18th century. There are some references that are slightly older. I mean, Daniel Defoe has one of the first references to it. Again, in terms of the etymology, Jones, whether it comes from Jonah, because obviously Jonah and the whale and haunting the sea. There's lots of different theories, and all kind of, like all these things, they all carry favor and seem to have a lot of weight. And then someone else go, that doesn't sound right. You know, I don't think we'll ever know. I think it's most likely a distortion of words that has come about over the years. And I think the Jonah thing probably isn't much of a stretch. But certainly it seems to be kind of 18th, maybe 17th century that it was really coming into place. Obviously, in recent times, Pirates of the Caribbean have really brought it forward. Now, yes. I'm not a big, I haven't really watched many of those films. Some of it is, you know, it's not really my thing, but I think some of the ships and things, I think, gosh, you know, they look kind of beautiful. But I know nothing about them other than Bill Nye, I think, played Davy Jones himself. I think there was... It's interesting as well, because it also links to what you're saying about warnings. There are talks about it being the case that there was actually a pirate called Davy Jones. Again, it seems possibly unlikely, but some sources seem to think so, and in which case he was so sort of feared, a bit kind of like Edward Teach Blackbeard kind of scenario. It became known about his kind of, you know, if you join Davy Jones's locker, basically is a colloquialism for sailors that have drowned or have died. But he kind of, if he was real, sort of thought of as the devil of the sea. Now, Davy Jones is considered by sailors still the devil of the sea. And really, it is a term of the sea, but it's also the bottom of the sea. And I think that in itself is so spooky. And a locker, again, was an old term that still is around for an enclosed space. So you can see how it came into being.
Yeah.
But I think it's one of those that keeps creeping back into the vernacular, into the psyche, because it's so eerie. Because the thing is, we don't know. I know they have done some things at the bottom of the sea, but it's such an unknown, uncharted country that I think it's so fascinating, this idea of Davy Jones's locker, the fact that this phrase eventually came into being, that has been largely untouched for the last kind of 300 years as a phrase. But where did it fully originate from? We don't know. And it links nicely into this idea of the Flying Dutchman as well. So I'm going to kind of go a little bit into... ghost ships, if that's okay, because talking about Davy Jones's locker and what happens at the sea, but what happens before those guys reach Davy Jones's locker. Ghost ships, I find fascinating, because when we say ghost ship, I'm sure you're the same, you kind of maybe get this idea of like things like the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, kind of a painted ship upon an idol as a painted ship upon a painted ocean, this kind of like eerie, sinister ship just going along. They are actually a thing. Kind of going into the modern era in terms of not just like a ghost sighting, but actual just abandoned empty ships. So, which I think is so cool, is that in their kind of purest form is what they are. So people would encounter these for varying reasons. So of course, in some cases there would have been pestilence or something that killed everybody aboard, maybe an accident, something like that. Maybe there were faults with the ship and so they were abandoned and then just left. Pirates, so sometimes in some cases people felt at risk. Remember, they're saying that maybe a pirate, so they abandoned ship again. There's all these different reasons as to why these ships would float across the ocean, and some have more of an enigma than others. So the Flying Dutchman, of course, which everybody knows, and if you go, I can't remember if it's Alton Towers or Drayton Manor, one of them has a very famous boat ride that's called the Flying Dutchman, I think. And again, it's another one that is, and I think on Pirates of the Caribbean, again, I think his ship is the Flying Dutchman.
Yeah.
So there's all these kind of ideas. It seems most likely that it's the kind of the Dutch trading company, and that's kind of where it came from as a name. Unlike a lot of ghost ships, sorry, it's not actually an established ship ever.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Which I thought was really interesting. It's one that kind of came into being as a ghost ship and has always been. There are stories in some cases where people think it was real, and mostly they are substantiated ghost stories. That's it, really. And it's considered something that you're going to love. It's a bit of an omen. It's a bit of a foreboding.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you love these kind of important type things. It would appear when something obviously bad was going to happen, or if, you know, it was considered a grave omen if you encountered this ghost ship. And then stories came from that, which actually the Pirates of the Caribbean did get right, was that the captain of the ship, according to the old story as well, is that once a decade, once every 10 years, he could stand on shore and he had to find a woman. He had to find true love and a woman that would stay faithful to him. And until then, he was destined to sail the seas for eternity, basically.
And
so it's fascinating. And there's lots of people over the years have claimed to encountered him, and namely around places like the Cape of Good Hope. And I think it's really, really fascinating. And one that I wrote down because I wanted to absolutely get the dates right on here. So these are all my notes, but we've got the Flying Dutchman. The one was the, I'm rustling away here, is the Mary Celeste, because these are the notes that I wanted to get right. So Mary Celeste is, apart from the Flying Dutchman, is probably the most famous ghost ship. So she seems the obvious one. There's lots of ones to talk about, but I thought, look, time-wise, let's do the Mary Celeste because she is super, super famous. She left New York in early November in 1872. And she was sailing towards Italy, and she was a merchant ship that was carrying alcohol, it said. And the captain was Benjamin Briggs, who took his wife and his two-year-old daughter, who I think was called Sophia. I think that's right. I didn't write her name down, but I think that's right. And his crew was of seven people. And what is really strange about this one is that when the ship was encountered, all their belongings, everything was undisturbed. So it's really, really eerie. The sail had been partially set. A log entry had not been made for the last 10 days and a lifeboat was missing. So they could well have, you know, gone over, escaped. But there was no indication as to what could have happened or why they would do that sort of thing. So also that there was water in the hold. So there was no risk of sinking. And so they do think there are some theories that maybe Briggs thought, perhaps erroneously, that something was wrong with the ship. So he got everybody to kind of go off and sail off. I think the thing is that's odd about this is they never made themselves known again. So
yeah,
you've got to assume if that did happen and they made it safely to land, by that point of the 19th century, most places it would have been able to kind of make themselves known again, but they never did. They just completely vanished. There's no real kind of substantial evidence as to what happens. That there were some ideas of things like mutiny, but there's nothing on the ship was damaged or indicated any kind of takeover by control or violence or anything like that. And again, there was no real sign of natural anything kind of that might have gone wrong with the ship. And there were fears of, they say, gas links and the alcohol that was being carried. But again, there's no indication of any damage. So it's really, really strange. She is one of those, again, that now, although she actually genuinely existed, is said to have appeared to a few different people. And in fact, there was one, Labobon? I can't remember the name. There was one ghost ship that the Queen's son, Edward, was said to have seen as well. And he talked about it.
Oh, really? That's cool.
The documentary, and I was like, that's really cool. And I can't remember, it's Labobon or something like that, but it's supposed to appear every 50 years. And it didn't appear in 1994. And so they're sort of thinking, is she due to kind of, you know, appear at some point, hopefully in our lifetime?
Yeah, but that'd be cool.
She did appear since the 19th century. She did appear, apparently, every 50 years. And then for some reason, 1994 didn't happen. No sightings. But I find it so fascinating. And I think this idea of the Mary Celeste, it's just that there's no real indication of anything other than the lifeboat's missing. But that's it. There's no disturbance. Like, where did they go?
Yeah, what happened? I think when you hear about things at sea, like the Mary Celeste, it's so bizarre, and it really just piques that curiosity, because it's like, well, why? And I think we'll never truly know the answer unless, you know, miraculously their diaries or that they can't pop up, it was hundreds of years ago, but you know, unless there is some sort of substantial kind of evidence, we'll never know why. But then that is one of the reasons why we're so enthralled by these, is because it's, well, why? And I think there's a lot about the sea that makes you feel like that. It's that idea of the fact that we've not explored so much of it. We know what is on Earth, but we don't know what's below water. And it leads to all those kind of, you know, insane kind of ancient aliens type things and things like that, but also things like ghost ships. And I love the idea of them being omens and portents of kind of death, particularly because sailors were quite superstitious, because you are in an environment that is so unpredictable. So naturally you would become so kind of superstitious and so worried about those kind of things. I did a little bit of looking into kind of sailors' tattoos, because I found out my great-grandfather was a sailor, and he actually, sadly, he passed away on ship. So we don't know exactly what happened, but it seems that he fainted and ended up overboard and then drowned of his kind of his condition. But I found out that he had the sailor tattoos, and it was the idea of the ones for good luck, and some of them were a sign of like a badge of honor of where you'd been and what you'd done, and some of them represented how many miles you'd have. So like the swallow was, I think, 5,000 nautical miles. I don't know what a nautical mile is. I imagine it's slightly more than a regular mile, but if anyone knows, let me know, educate me. But I think all of these things, and I think it's probably similar to the death omens we talked about, is that when you are in such an unpredictable environment, these stories and these ideas pop up. And I think that probably, to me, is why some of these ghost ships endure. And also it's really cool. Like, I rather unculturedly, I think the first ghost ship I ever saw in popular culture was one on SpongeBob.
Yeah, but that's probably the case for a lot of people, because, you know, like I say, like the Mary Celeste, the thing is, like, their son, they had a son as well, but he stayed at home. So he has family, you know, ancestors in America. They never came back. Like, yeah, and I think in the popular psyche, that SpongeBob, things like that, and for, you know, a generation kind of younger than us as well, or maybe only just a bit, like things like Pirates of the Caribbean, most of these were kind of bringing things like this, and the Goonies as well, of course, at the end of the Goonies, and the Pirate Coves and things like that, are bringing that into the mainstream culture in a way that, to be honest, like, I know we kind of poo-poo that and laugh, but actually weren't things like sea shanties and stories like that just the same version but in their day? Because the sea shanties are pretty bawdy, and a lot of those were a rhythm that kind of worked with the sailors, like the type of work they were doing. So it was a beat that maybe every second beat or something was for the pull of a rope or whatever. So like the Drunken Sailor is a great example, or you've got ones like from the Peninsula Wars. So they had songs like Spanish Ladies, which is a really famous one.
Yeah.
It was about their Spanish wives that they couldn't bring home because they already had English wives. So, you know, you're like, oh, I'm a bit debauched. But these, you know, like, we're kind of laughing at SpongeBob, but actually things like the shanties and stuff were kind of like the really sort of like the Viz like comic of their day. Like, they were really bawdy.
Yeah.
You know, it's fascinating, isn't it? And I think the other thing I find so interesting as well about these ghost ships and them being important is, you know, people say there's no indication that anything was wrong with the ship, but, you know, like, you and I, we're landlubbers, most people are, and like, when these ships kind of come ashore or something, maybe they're looking at them with a set of eyes that aren't like a sailor's eyes, that don't know how to read ships. You know how like certain historians know how to read buildings and things like this?
Yeah,
you know, you're looking for, maybe people are looking at those thinking there's nothing overtly wrong with this ship.
Looks like a ship to me. You know, like, yeah, no, that really makes sense.
Exactly, like the one off SpongeBob, there's nothing wrong. Maybe, yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's all conjecture, isn't it? I mean, ultimately, apart from the fact that Mary Celeste did exist, yeah, things like the Flying Dutchman, just a very cool story, but the way they survive, like that, the Flying Dutchman has to be the most famous. Like, including, like, I mean, it's found its way into theme parks. Like that.
And SpongeBob, because I think the SpongeBob episode I'm remembering, it was called The Frying Dutchman.
Oh, yeah, okay. So that is, see, look at those guys. They, that, play on words. I saw a hip shot once called The Codfather, and I was like, fair play.
Yeah,
these guys are slightly tenuous, but, you know, just in terms of, like, you know, nautical names, I was like, that's not unclever, is it? That was quite a funny name. I thought they'd done quite well there. So superstitions, and I feel like you can probably join me on this because you're always the queen of this kind of thing, but I know there was a couple. So, for example, there was no whistling on board because they thought that the whistling kind of would encourage the wind, didn't it? And encourage...
That's cool. I didn't actually know that.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. Because I think, because we've discussed before, as you were talking about whistling in mines and things like that, which I think is fascinating. And one that I did just quickly want to add, because I thought it was fascinating, was the naming of ships, is that they weren't to be renamed without a ceremony, because the idea was that Poseidon or Neptune, depending on, you know, whether it's your Greek or Roman mythology. But if we go with Poseidon, he had a list, a logbook. I love this. They sailors believe that he had a logbook of all nautical vessels, so he knew what was out there. And if you renamed it, so say if we had, you know, the ship was called Amy or something, and then we decided to rename it, I don't know, whatever, like we called it Misha after my cat, yeah. And there was no ceremony or nothing about it, so Poseidon wasn't updated, shit was going to hit the fan. Like, that's it. You risk kind of encouraging his wrath, and in which case you do not want to do that.
No.
And so I find that so interesting that there's still this kind of ceremony around naming ships, but I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think I love the idea of anyone having a logbook, anyone supernatural, but particularly a god of the sea, because it's I'm probably putting too much thought into it, but the technicalities of, you know, where does he keep it? How does he keep it dry? Yeah. Is it special paper? Is it special ink?
That's what I'd be like as well. I'd be like, how are you doing that, Poseidon? What's the deal?
Yeah, and then they'd probably just be like, Amy, shut up. Just go with it. It's fine. But no, I think that's interesting. And I think what's interesting to me is the idea that when you have these kind of more dangerous professions like mining, and which I'm sure we'll do a whole episode on because there's loads to talk about, and sailing and you know, being at sea in these unpredictable environments, that these superstitions develop. And I do believe that superstitions shouldn't be looked down on as much as we probably do in our society, modern society, because I think they are, if anything, they're a coping mechanism. I think we do not, as human beings, enjoy unpredictability. We like comfort. We like, you know, even the most free-spirited person likes to know exactly what is happening.
Yeah.
And understand the possible outcomes. So if we're in a position where we can't control something like nature, like the sea, and I think the sea probably embodies this more than anything else I can think of, really, of the unpredictability. Mm. We like to be able to create little things to keep us safe, or to if we do A, B, and C, it means that D will happen, that kind of thing. And I think that's why stuff like this endures. And I think that's also why we're so fascinated by it.
Mm. I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's, no matter, you know, you get lots of people who are like, oh, I'm really edgy, I just go with the flow. You're like,
yeah,
you don't. Because there'll be kind of parts of your behavior that are absolutely classically habitual. Like, that's supposed to just take the same route to work, obviously, because it's logical, but there'll be the same patterns of behavior. And again, like I think I said before, most of us are sort of saluting magpies and things. And a lot of these meanings are lost to the peacekeeper of time, but we still do them. And we don't always know why, but we do. So even those people who are like, oh, I just run against the grain. Spoiler, if you say that you run against the grain, you probably don't.
Yes.
But I think it's fascinating because, yeah, I think rituals, most of them, of course, and there must have been a part of them that probably sort of recognize that these are unlikely to work. But, you know, like this idea of salt, if you pass salt to another sailor, it had to touch the table and then the other sailor, which I thought was really cool. And another thing was kind of about days of the week that you could and couldn't sail on. So a Friday you couldn't because it was a crucifixion. And then I believe Sunday was good luck. You know, these kind of things. And there were certain clergymen and things that were considered bad luck. Women, calsapries, were considered generally bad luck to take on board because, you know, obviously, up to all sorts, wouldn't they? You know what women are like, if they get involved, we just can't help ourselves, apparently.
No, and, you know, if you take your English wife with you, then they'll meet your Spanish wife, and then your French wife will get involved, and then before you know it...
Exactly. You've all got the French kissing disease. Do you know what I mean? So it's tricky, isn't it? Which they're probably going to get when their husband gets home anyway. So you know, to cut out the middleman. But yeah, it's true. It's, you know, I mean, it was considered a distraction for the men, like distraction from what? From the adultery.
Yeah.
Anyway, but hey, look, you know, you don't want your wife on board. It's a massive cock block. So yeah, stay at home. It's better. But, you know, I it's the same as like animals that were considered good luck. So I've got a calico, Admiral, we've got a calico cat that she's a right character, but they were considered very good luck, and black cats were as well. I mean, basically they were ratters, weren't they? But
yeah,
the other thing that's fascinating is the albatross, because of course I'm going back to the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, but the idea that they shot the albatross was really frowned upon because large birds like that were considered to carry the souls of dead sailors.
Yeah.
So it shot them. Yeah, I know. And I thought it was really, really fascinating. And even the start of the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, he's going, you know, got this old mariner telling this story to a wedding guest. He's a bit like, oh, the wedding's going to start, so I'm not sure I should listen. But then is kind of so enthralled by this sailor's charisma. And that is still something that survives, this idea that all sailors are fishermen, you know, with yeah. their shanty and their stories. They see things that we land lovers will never see. So whatever they tell us is already laced with fascination. And you have this image of this kind of, you know, like a more modern fisherman in their kind of their thick fisherman's yeah. jumper, in fact, which are actually yeah. quite large. And their kind of skin that's weather-beaten, and they're going to have all these stories and things that they've seen, and, you know, animals like the kraken, these giant squids that live somewhere out in Norway that can engulf an entire ship. You know, like you kind of touched on this idea that the sea holds so much mystery for us. And most of us, even if we go on sailing holidays or go, you know, out on a cruise or whatever it may be, there's still this kind of, like, the North Sea is a really good example of a really sinister...
Yeah.
We see that still kind of, I mean, it definitely had TikTok in a kind of headlock, didn't it? For about a year last year, all these people were kind of putting up a shanty and,
yeah.
and they were like, oh my God, this is insane. And we're like, well, that's quite creepy. But even going into things like the Loch Ness Monster, it's not the sea, but these creatures that maybe do or don't exist or disproportionately larger or not, anything that's not typical to us becomes folkloric, whether it's real or not. They are suddenly folkloric, and they survive in their own strange space in our minds. Yeah. Seems to be reserved for the sea and bodies of water. I find it fascinating and obsessive. I don't know about you, but I always want to Google, how deep is Loch Ness? How dark is the sea when you go really deep? You know, because suddenly just got, you can't, like, anything you can't comprehend, like when they say that Loch Ness after a certain amount, not far, is like pitch black, and we're like, oh, scary. And
yeah.
Like, water caves, and the fact that there's like bodies floating around there because these adrenaline junkies have gone sea cave diving, whatever they call it, and died.
Yeah.
And the fact that also within that, that I think there's something happens to your body that when you die, like it can all, I think any like body fat turns like wax, so these bodies can kind of almost become like buoyant. So they're in these caves kind of bobbing. Oh.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's
yeah,
it.
No. That's not so folkloric as much as terrifying, but there must be things like this that people saw, didn't know what it was, and then tried to explain it. And
yeah.
thus these creepy stories come into being. But yeah, spooky.
I think it's really interesting you mentioning about how like sailors being seen as like authority and having all these fantastical tales. And in one regard, they probably were, because, you know, if I like someone from Shropshire, you know, from a farmer from Shropshire, will understand their farm, they'll understand the world around them incredibly well. They don't know necessarily, but I'm talking like hundreds and hundreds of years ago now, I'm not talking about now.
I'm not going to offend anyone, don't worry.
No, I'm not, no.
They would, at the moment, got enough to worry about in the news.
Yes, they have. Then, yeah.
We're fine.
But they wouldn't necessarily know what went beyond their realm of experience, the access of their world. So if you've got someone sat in a pub telling you fantastical tales, it's not necessarily that you would believe it, but you would be enthralled because it was so very different to your own experiences. And I think that's what would have made it so exciting. And that's how we would get mermaids being transferred from seas beyond our understanding to the local pool or the local area, because you've heard this story. And I think there is something very innate in human beings. I mean, we're doing it right now where we hear a story and we have to tell it on and have to tell another person. So conceivably you could imagine some old jockey sat in not a literal jockey, but
no, I get the Shropshire.
For people who aren't from Shropshire, a jockey
just
is
non-Shropshire listeners.
Yeah, an old man.
Walsh. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
But you can imagine some old man sat in a pub telling tales of his time at sea, and then someone hearing it and going, right, well, I love that story, I'm going to tell it on. And that's how we develop these. And then also that's how I think probably it happened amongst sailors as well. You'd have sailors going, oh, well, I saw this ghost ship, or I had this experience. And then, oh, well, I've had a similar experience. Perhaps that I had was this. And I think that's what's so powerful about folklore and about the oral tradition and about storytelling in general, is that it's innately personal, but it also is so interconnected to the human experience. And it's just fascinating. I love it. I could talk about it all day.
So extraordinary. And I wonder if that's why, like, shanties kind of prevail the way they do, partly because considering they're considered songs that you can sing, whether you can sing or not, and they're not sort of tune focused, their tunes are insane. Like, you know, there's just these old saying, it's like, watch out, I'm going to drop a beat now. Okay. This tune is absolutely sick. Like, and they're like, it's a song about a woman with syphilis. Let's go. And everyone's like, yay. Whereas, like, if anyone else went, someone's like singing a song about, like, I mean, I suppose apart from like the Victorians, like, you know, or music hall or something, where they're like, oh, we dropped me car and my dad did, you know, like, you love all that kind of stuff. But like, the sailors are like, I don't know, like, she was blind, she had a venereal disease, and it was her fault. And we're like, hooray, sing us more, tell us more about this tale. You know, like, and then my mum died, and then my cat died, and then there was a, you know, a ghost ship. But like, we love it. And a lot of the, like, the lyrics don't have to make sense. Like the drunken sailor, case in point, you know, like, stick on, wait till he's sober, like, jump into bed with the captain's daughter, but she's a bit rank, so it doesn't matter. You know, like, all these things that, like, just, you think, bloody hell, like, none of these are exactly, like, you know, they're not the most salubrious lyrics, but we love them. And I think if it's because it's kind of something that's othered, in a sense, it feels like it belongs to us, but it doesn't, because most of us are not seafaring folk. So we kind of get, you know, when you get like people playing like the countryside, or like if you're from the country, you kind of go, oh, you know, the upper Wummers, we're in the city now. You know, you kind of get like, you know, you guys, you got your jock if you've got our Mons. Like, I'm South Shropshire, so we're like some married Mon. But like, you kind of feel, if like when you sing a shanty, you belong to something, and you belong to this kind of slightly idyllic version of what life on the sea was like, but we're like, we're part of something now. We're like, our beloved Morris dancing represents the countryside in a way that it doesn't hugely, but you know, sea shanties, we're like, we're practically pirates and sailors, but we're reminded of pirates, and you're like, they're still pirates. Like, go out and kind of like into the seas in Africa and things, and like, the you know, your ships can get stolen still, and you're stabbed or shot, but you know, so don't. But you know, pirates were brutal. And really cool, and they had really brutal punishments, but we're like, romantic. They had boots up to their knees and good songs, you know. And you're like, yeah, not quite sure that's true, but it's funny how for some reason the sea has mythologized itself, because I suppose you can never fully know. It's so vast, it's so big. And also because, whether, I suppose in my theory, you've got machinery, you've got the modern world, nothing can tame the sea, can you? Like, she's a bit of a wild old girl. So, you know, it doesn't matter if she seems to have settled and calm, and she's like, watch out, I'm coming for you. And I think I love that. No matter what you do, you can put wind turbines out there, you can do what you want. The sea's like, I'm going to fuck shit up. And you're like, why? You just want to, really. And you're like,
because okay. I can.
And we're like, it's all right. We'll sing a song about you in a minute in a pub in Foy. It's great. I love it. I think it's, you know, coming from the most inland county, I still think we're fascinated by the sea. We love the fact that the Severn in some way or another eventually gets to the sea, and we're like, you're practically pirates. And you're like, are you? Well, we like old stories in water.
There's a band called The Longest Johns, and they do sea shanties. They're amazing. And they've got a song about being pirates. They're from Bristol, and they've got the song about pirates and sailing up and down the River Severn as pirates. And it's wonderful. It's hilarious. They are hilarious. They really embody, kind of, because they do their own sea shanty style music, but then they also do older songs like What Do We Do with the Drunken Sailor and Oak and Ash and Thorn and things like that. So, but I love the idea of someone sailing up and down the River Severn trying to be a pirate. It's just excellent.
I mean, it does also show that arguably, especially if anyone from Shrewsbury are going to say, clearly they don't know the River Severn, because as it flows through Shrewsbury, you are not going on the vessel there pretend to be a pirate. You want to be dragged under by the undertow, and then you've been there's like a fire engine, all sorts going down, wild cop, and you're like, who is it? It's like, oh, pretend to be pirates again, were they?
Yeah, you come
you're
on.
Like, oh mate,
get out
like,
of the river, lads.
Keep it landbound. There's plenty to pretend to be. Take up Morris dancing. Like, you know, that's a bit more sharp, so you'll be fine. The Severn is brutal. Don't do that, lads. It's not
right.
Go on then. So you mentioned at the start that you'd got another story for us.
Yes. So I want to go right near where I'm from and talk about an area all round the Wrekin. It's no secret that I love the Wrekin. I absolutely love it. For a geological feature, I have an insane amount of love for it. It's a hill. I shouldn't love it as much as I do, but I do. Because to me, yeah. I think growing up in Telford, growing up in really with it being the access to my known world, it's phenomenal. And it's got such a rich history. It's got such a rich kind of mythology and folklore around it. A week after the beginning of the English Civil War. He didn't try and build a wall. He started a war. A week after the English Civil War, I've said it again.
Do you know what?
A week after that war.
They're going to cut us some slack. You're doing really well.
Yeah. That's, yeah, it's fine. Well done, Amy.
War. Yeah, that sounded really patronizing. It wasn't mentioned. Sorry. War. That is quite hard. Go on. Yeah, you've
got
it.
A week after the civil event, the unrest, Charles I was actually at the base of the Wrekin. He was gathering his troops and he was meeting his sons there. So you've got this landmark that's actually got such a link to local history, but also kind of British history. You had hermits living on the Wrekin in the medieval period, at least three we know about, one of which was sponsored by our actual king. So I think it was Henry III actually sponsored him and allowed him to kind of live on the Wrekin and do his hermit stuff in order to kind of increase the piety of the country.
Yeah.
If you move just... So there's the Forest Glen car park.
Mm.
If you go down the road and go up, you're kind of at the foot of the Arkell, which is another little hill next to the Wrekin. Yeah. And that's the site of this story. So there's a place, go down from the Forest Glen car park up a hill, and there's a place called Dairy Pit, or sometimes Davy Pit, which I think, interestingly, with what we've been talking about, I've never known why the Davy is there and why it was known as Davy, but could it be Davy Jones Locker? Yeah, we don't know.
I think it probably could. Yeah.
But it's certainly plausible. Mm. And Dairy Pit is possibly one of the most interesting features of the folklore of the Wrekin area, I think.
Yeah.
Because it is a very, very, very kind of... Well, one witness remarked that it was a weird place enough, which I think sums it up. It's got such a huge body of stories that are about its kind of otherworldly presence, its negativity, its associations with wickedness. Yeah. And rather interestingly, there was an old holy well on the Wrekin, and it was so holy, it was so kind of well known amongst all the locals that no one actually thought to write it down where it was. So it's now lost.
Because they just assumed that everyone would always
know. Yeah, they're like, everyone will know. But then one day, someone was told that they knew they were suffering from an illness, and they were told to go up to the Wrekin, go to the holy pit, the holy well, sorry, and drink the water to cure themselves. So this poor old fella goes up to the Arkell, he goes to Dairy Pit, drinks the water and nearly kills himself because he got confused and thought it was the holy well, when in fact it was actually probably more like an unholy well.
He's got the shits. Yeah. Probably, yeah. Do you know where it's got to find it? Can you go all like Philippa Langley but find the holy well?
Yeah, I'd love to do that. Should we do it? Should we make it the podcast's mission to find the holy well?
Yes, obviously. I feel like if anyone can do it, you can.
We can do it.
Then I'll just ride off the back of it. I mean,
this is me now, founder of the holy well.
I'll be like, this is co-research. And people are like, spoiler, it wasn't. I did everything. Like, of course. But yeah, sorry, carry on.
No, it's fine. And Dairy Pit, I've got to say, when I went up there, I've been up there several times now, it does have a weird vibe. There's not many places in Shropshire that I've written about that are haunted or that are spooky or that have a weird vibe. Some of them, it's like, oh, okay, maybe it's a bit old. Littleshall Abbey is one. We will talk about Littleshall Abbey another day, but that is one of the weirdest places I've ever been.
I want to go because you told me about this. Like, it sounds so cool. Never been, but oh,
it's, yeah. But I've got to say, Dairy Pit, it had an atmosphere. So it's actually, it's not natural water source. It's an old bell pit from kind of, they think maybe the late 1600s, some of the earliest types of mining, but it is very deep. It does look very unnatural when you go. And when I went, the water had a thick layer of green algae that was kind of sitting on the surface.
God.
And it felt very heavy. It felt like a very heavy environment. And it simultaneously felt very kind of heavy and like there was a buzz of something, but also as if there was the stillness of the forest, and it was a weird juxtaposition, but it has a very interesting kind of body of folklore that is attached to it. It was described in 1840 as being dark waters that were regarded with dread because many spirits were laid underwater there. So in Shropshire, as with other places, when you have a troublesome ghost, the best thing you can do is do a little ritual with a group of priests, trap that ghost in a bottle and chuck it in a water source, because ghosts find it hard to leave water and bodies of water. They become trapped there. I think we mentioned it in a previous episode where we talked about the troublesome ghost that was Stanton on Heath Hine with the one that was trapped. So this is said to have been something that happened an awful lot at Dairy Pit. They were said to, anywhere where in the area that had a ghost problem, you'd trap it in a bottle and chuck it in Dairy Pit.
Logical. But I mean, so, still, I love it. So gothic.
Yeah. So the waters are said to be really, really filled with spirits.
Mm-hmm.
As well as that, though, there are said to be a number of spirits that are haunting the area as well. So you've got the ghosts in the water, you've got the ghosts in the area, and you've got our last mermaid story. Now, Charlotte Byrne mentioned in A Sheaf of Gleanings that people were actually really quite scared of the area around Dairy Pit, which I think is really interesting, because Telford, as we know it now, is very different to Telford 100 years ago or 150 years ago. Telford was such an industrialised landscape, and the scars of that can still be seen all over the Ironbridge Gorge, for instance, or, you know, Benfell Edge or places like that. So people would have been familiar with what a bell pit looked like, or what, you know, mining looked like, what industry looked like. So it's not necessarily that people didn't understand what Dairy Pit was, because these things would have littered the landscape all over the area. Some of them might not have been as old as Dairy Pit, but certainly it doesn't come from a lack of understanding of their own environment, because they lived it, they understood what the industry was like in the area. So I think a lot of this negative kind of attachment that comes to the pit has got to come again from the oral tradition, from these stories coming from people having strange experiences and creating that narrative. But Charlotte Byrne says that people would actively go miles out of their way to avoid the pit because they were seeing it as such a negative atmosphere. There is several ghosts that are said to haunt Dairy Pit, but perhaps the most famous is Aud Rutter.
Aud Rutter?
Yes, excellent name. No innuendos to be found there.
I was going to say, no pressure, Aud Rutter, but you better bring it.
And he is said to have been a 17th century pack horse driver.
Okay.
And he was a hardworking man. You can't fault him for his word. But at night, he would fetch himself a drop of the drink and drink until he was probably well and truly sloshed.
Yeah.
But then he would argue with his wife. Mm. She would curse and shout, and he would shout back, and then they'd both raise fists at each other, and it would get very hairy very quickly with them.
Yeah.
And much damage was caused in the process. And then they'd wake up, he'd go to work, she'd probably do whatever she needed to do. He'd come home, they'd have tea, and it would happen again and again and again. And eventually, she got really tired of his shit. Who possibly would? And she poisoned Aud Rutter. She poisoned his beer. And in some versions of the story, I love the idea of her, because at some versions of the story, she said to have actually done it at Dairy Pit. So I don't know how. I'll come for a walk with me. I'll bring you beer with me. I'll drink this, plop, into the waters. But in other versions, she poisons him at home, lays his spirit, and casts it into the pit itself. And his spirit is said to wander the sites surrounding the pool alongside countless nameless ones who are witnessing things, who witness him, but also it's kind of this weird idea of like layered spirits. So they are witnessing the ghosts just as they are the ghosts. And honestly, it seems that it is positively jam-packed, which is very bizarre because it is so quiet up there, because not still to this day, not many people know exactly where it is.
I didn't know anything about it.
And there have been a few references to kind of more modern sightings or people stumbling upon it and feeling uneasy or having a sense of dread, or that more feelings than actual apparitions. But Oud Rutter is one that is described as being seen in various intonations across history. Now, one thing I love is there's a man who was very local to me, George Evans. He did a lot of work. I would probably say he's the Wrekin's most notable son, because he was such a champion of the Wrekin. He wrote a lot of books about his own experiences as kind of a peace activist, as also his experiences in the war and things like that. But he really was a champion for the Wrekin. And he used to say that the only way you could truly know whether Dairy Pit was haunted was to go on a silent moonlight night when the moon is full and take note of your reaction. So he said you shouldn't poo-poo these stories, because if you were up there of a night time on your own, you'd probably be a bit scared, which I love the idea of. I grew up kind of with George Evans being quite prominent in the area and being, as I said, a champion of the Wrekin. But I just love the idea of him going, ghosts might not exist, but just see how brave you are if you go up there of a night time. And as I said, I wouldn't like to go up there of a night time. It was spooky enough in day.
Moon full or otherwise, I'm not going up there. I mean, I know what's going to happen. Just going to be like, jump out my skin.
Then I'd probably fall in Dairy Pit because I'm very clumsy. You'd be like,
oh. Hi,
Edwata. Oops. Other than the ghosts, that is said to be a mermaid that lives in Dairy Pit. I can kind of get the vibe. Like when I said, when I went up there, it was incredibly green, algae-filled water. And she's said to be particularly fearsome, a violent mermaid who loves nothing more than seducing men with a song before dragging men down, drowning them and claiming their souls.
Yeah.
Excellent.
We do love to do that.
Queen behaviour.
Yeah, exactly. Normal. Yeah.
I think the way you could sum up Dairy Pit's folklore is there's sadly an unnamed person who was quoted in the 1800s as calling it a place of horrors. Love it. Absolutely love it. But I find it really interesting because it falls into all the kind of cautionary tales like Jenny Greenteeth dragging people to their death. Only this time it's men with Jenny Greenteeth, it's children. Yeah. And also just this idea of it being kind of a site for chucking ghosts in. Like, oh, well, I've got this ghost problem. It's all right, lad, bottle it up and chuck it in the pit. Like, it's just brilliant. Absolutely brilliant, I think.
It's amazing. And I wonder, like, you know, if you did the equivalent of mudlarking there, how many bottles you might find.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Sure as hell, I'm not opening any. Like, you know what? Whether people believe in it or not, I'm not lucky enough to go, pop the cork. Yeah, no.
That's one ghost free. That's another one.
You're like, oh, let's see what happens. Let's not. I think it's so. I was kind of having a quick look on Google at the picture while I was listening to it, because it was kind of. It was good listening to you describe it as I looked at the picture, and I was like, oh, spooky. It really does. It looks so eerie in its own kind of space, which I said it because it is the same space. But I would encourage people, anyone listening, to go ahead and Google that, and to, you know, better still, if possible, go and visit it, because I think we're just going to have a sound structure, which is Day Out in North
York. Yes, definitely. And if anyone wants directions, I'm happy to help with that, because I followed, when I went looking for it, I went down a route that sent me literally all around the Wrekin, and I didn't end up where I needed to be. So then we regrouped and we went the next day, and it is literally so close to the Forest Glen car park. So anyone wants any more information, let us know. But we definitely need to have a little bit of a visit and maybe even do a cheeky little bit of extra content there.
I'd love that. I mean, in the daytime, because I
not at night.
No. I'd be too scared. Like, what if I needed a wee or something? I'd be like, no. <I'm> just, like, that has just got like trauma written all over it. Like, yeah. No. So I'm going to tell one story now. Only a kind of a brief one, but I find it very, very spooky. So it's quite famous. It's the Flannan Islands lighthouse mystery. It's a mystery. So in 1900 on Boxing Day, they went to the lighthouse. Now this is a kind of a tower lighthouse with a sort of adjacent the building attached to it, but there is some land. So you know how some are on rocks and obviously they can, you know, the rooms are kind of 12 foot and you can
walk from
the side in 3 paces. You can't go outside really. Things like this has got a bit of land and things like that. So you can kind of, the men could move around and things. So there were three men, which historically, and I didn't realize this until recently, actually, it was always two men until I think it's about the mid 18th century. They changed to three because there was a lighthouse in Wales somewhere, and vagaries, I know, but there were two lighthouse keepers and one of them had died. And the chap was so worried that he was going to be found like guilty of his murder when he hadn't murdered him, be natural causes, that he left him dead basically in the chair or wherever he was until they came and brought relief, because he was so worried that they'd be like, well, where is he? Where is he buried? Like, you know, because obviously it's quite serious nowadays. You can check and like that. But I mean, I totally get it. So they would have three lighthouse keepers, the pressure of which must have been intense. So you just got to consider that kind of listeners lifestyle wise. It's a very strange lifestyle. There are some that did it and did have their families and things and loved it. Mostly it was a very isolating job and they tended to be there for, I think it was about 2 months. And then obviously they would have people coming to send relief. Now, going back to the story, on Boxing Day, they came ashore and they found the lighthouse totally deserted, but it was meticulously clean. Now that isn't kind of unusual in itself because they kept these really clean, because obviously, you know, aside from the fact that they could have had lighthouse inspectors at any point, also if you were living in a space like that, it stands to reason if you couldn't go anywhere that you would keep it immaculate, wouldn't you, for your own sanity, to which point it probably became like a real focal point to keep everything immaculate. So it's fascinating. So they went there and everything was spotless. There was food on the table, which obviously had been left and wasn't fresh. And the logbook, I believe the clocks had stopped, the wicks had been altered. And I believe it was about the 15th of December was the last time the logbook had anything written in it. What was strange is there weren't really reports of storms or anything at that point. From back then, and all their kind of rough weather gear, so oil skins, I can't remember what they're called, but the, you know, these outfits that they would wear together were all still hanging up. So it stands to reason that no matter how quickly you would have had to go out to do something, they would have put that gear on. These were experienced men, and I've got their names down here as well. So there was James Ducat, the principal lightkeeper, Thomas Marshall, assistant lightkeeper, and Donald MacArthur was the occasional lightkeeper who was on duty for William Ross, who was the assistant lightkeeper who was on sick leave. And there was another assistant lightkeeper called Joseph Moore, who was on shore duty. So those two men, obviously, for whatever happened, were quite lucky. There were indications that nothing abnormal happened again. So a bit like the Marie Celeste, there's no signs of violence. There was nothing unusual. These three men completely vanished. And there was no, nothing ever washed ashore, nothing strange ever. That was it. They just completely vanished. Some people have theorized that obviously, you know, maybe someone had gone there and, you know, had absconded some way and found some way of kind of getting someone to go over there and take them back to shore, but they never came back to light again, never went back to their families, nothing. And if it was one man, perhaps, but three to be in agreement with something like that, the chance of them not being seen, of not some trace of that, it's the start of the 20th century. You know, we're not talking like the 1500s or something.
Yeah.
You know, I know it's isolated out there, kind of, it's going up to the Hebrides, isn't it? But it's still... It's really, really strange. And then things started to happen. Like they said that when they'd got there, there were three large birds flying over the lighthouse. I mean, look, you know, these islands do attract birds and perhaps birds that not everybody was familiar with. that in itself becomes folkloric and spooky, and you do get stories that surround it, and people have been there to visit and things like that. But I find it so extraordinary. These three men, there was never an indication ever again of what happened to them. They just completely vanished. And I, look, as I said, people have said that maybe like a large wave came unexpectedly and took them all away, but there was nothing. There was no bodies left on the rocks or shorelines, like nothing. They just completely vanished. And it's so really
bizarre.
Yeah, I know. And I find it fascinating. And the more I read, the more like you can listen to podcasts about it, everything. There is just nothing substantial to say this happened, or one, you know, they stabbed, you know, like some people have said, oh, you know, maybe there was a scuffle and two were killed and the one then killed himself. Is he lugging these bodies out? The fact that you have to get far enough out to see that nothing washes up. Like, I don't know. It's all a bit, we'll never know. And it's not that long ago, really. I mean,
no, it's not.
It's not a medieval myth that's kind of been handed. These men existed. They had families, you know, and we'll never, ever know what happened to them. And they are, you know, on the island nearby, I think they are very respectful of it. And they talk about one of the saddest kind of periods of their history. So, and I think that's why it's important when I want to get their names down, to know what their names were, because I just think it's so desperately sad. And there are photographs of them. You can see the lighthouse. And I think maybe it's kind of worth describing the kind of look at these guys here. So James is kind of quite tall. The other two are smaller, but they've got these fabulous kind of 19th century, start of the century, 20th century moustaches. And, you know, one of the kind of, you know, they weren't like a huge age. The one, I think the oldest was sort of in his 50s.
Yeah.
So I do think it's one that maybe would have passed of something, you know, to do with age. It just all seems really strange. I think the youngest was about 22, something like that. I don't know. I mean, I could be wrong about that. I'm sure it was 30. One of them wasn't too old. Maybe he was in his 30s. But there's been poems and things written about it. And I just find it's extraordinary. And the lighthouse itself as well looks kind of gothic. It's almost exactly what you want. I'm kind of looking on the images now because I don't really know how you describe it. It looks a bit like if Grand Designs did a lighthouse. Do you know what I mean? It's got this kind of blockish looking building attached to it, and it looks spooky. And then obviously you get the obligatory black and white photographs and things, but I don't know what happened to them. We'll never know. People talk about it, like up to very recently people are still putting articles out there, and there's been films called The Vanishing and various things based on this, and we'll never know. Strange, just completely abandoned, spotless. Yeah, eerie, isn't it?
Yeah, it's eerie. And I think that's another thing about the sea that is so terrifying in a way, is its potential to not only take life, but also leave no trace.
Mm.
Because it's plausible that the sea is involved in some way. Men don't just vanish into thin air. You know, so where did they go? What happened to them? And I think the sea endures in our imaginations because its capacity to just baffle us at times, because things like this are so extraordinary that they are baffling. I mean, it's incredibly tragic, and we must always look at, as you said, the people. There actually were people. It's not like it's just a story. They are three men at the end of the day that lost their lives. But why? And I think we need to know the why, and human beings are so driven by the why. So then when we're confronted with no logical answers for it, folklore and myth and even conspiracy starts to grow.
Yeah, we saw three large birds. I say maybe that's them. They've come.
Yeah.
They do say that the birds come for the souls of the dead. You know, I think there's differing accounts, because on some accounts they say that James Ducat, it was clear that he'd gone down because of some weather situation. I think whether he'd taken his jacket, he'd gone down. So perhaps the others had followed him. But there's certainly an indication that the other two weren't clothed in the same way. I mean, did they just perish? Did they... We'll never know. And I think it's the fact that each account, even by people who are, you know, historians that have really looked into this, are always slightly different. But the dates are pretty consistent, and when they were last kind of logged and things like that. But it seems mostly that they weren't all wearing their out, you know, their poor weather gear and things like that. So we'll never know. We'll never know. So have you got any kind of parting thoughts on the sea, or anything you want to say to our kind of fellow landlubbers before we kind of, I was going to say, wash away, but just not that we're going to perish. But yeah,
Other than it's,
to add.
You know, other than it's bloody terrifying.
I'm really spooked out now. I'm like, yeah, like it's killed the vibe. I'm scared.
I think it's fascinating to think about how, I think if we turn to the sea-based folklore, how sea-based folklore can have a life of its own away from the sea, how we can have folkloric creatures and sea-based mythology, and also how stories of the sea are being told away from the sea. We have folklore books now, fantastic books about all of the collected myths of the sea. I keep calling it seaside, and that gives it kind of an Edwardian kind of feel to it.
But I always say seaside. That's like when people say the ocean or the beach. Yeah. I'm like, call it what it is. It's the seaside. The
seaside. So you don't need to be by the coast to enjoy these stories, and these stories also don't need the coast to endure. And I think that is so fascinating, and it's so exciting as well that you can have a creature like the mermaid in a pond in Shropshire, you know.
It never seems too tenuous, does it?
And
I thought I'd, because I've got it up, and I thought, look, I haven't learned this by rote, but I'd got it ready. I wonder if we could kind of part on a bit of the poem about the Flannan Isles by Wilfred Wilson Gibson. It's bloody long, so I'm only going to read a short part of it. But I think it's eerie and it's fab. So, though three men dwell on Flannan Isle to keep the lamp alight, as we steered under the lee, we caught no glimmer through the night. A passing ship at dawn had brought the news, and quickly we set sail to find out what strange thing might ail the keepers of the deep sea light.
Pooky. Wow.
I know, I love it. Would have been better if I hadn't sort of mumbled on the first couple of words and got it wrong, but hey.
No, that was brilliant. Perfect.
Fantastic. Thank you so, so much. We're going to be back with our next episode in a couple of weeks, and then we've got another couple, well, there'll be a few out before Christmas as well, so follow us on our socials, keep listening. Thank you so much if you've got as far as this episode and you've listened to every single one. Thank you if you've just joined us on this one. Great, they're all self-contained, so apart from the odd reference to previous jokes about severed penises and things, you know, you're welcome to the club at any point on any episode. So thank you so, so much for all the support, and we'll see you all very soon.
See you soon. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, bye.